Tested is sponsored by Duke Health, home of the Pandemic Response Network, helping communities stay safe and connected during the COVID-19 pandemic by partnering with local school, business, and faith-based organizations to launch COVID-19 symptom support programs in their own communities. Learn more at pandemicresponsenetwork.org. We're also supported by Hungry Harvest, delivering farm-fresh produce and kitchen staples to your door starting at $15. Every delivery fights food waste and supports local hunger-solving organizations. HungryHarvest.net.
This is not retreating from the coast. It's retreating from the places where we're just throwing money in the water.
I'm Dave DeWitt. This is Tested from WUNC, a look at what today's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, shifting sands. A few weeks ago, our family introduced our new dog to the beach. It was cold, cloudy, and a little blustery, but the magic of Pine Knoll Shores did not disappoint. Whether your beach is Topsail, Bald Head, Ocracoke, or Corolla, families here have built memories and recharged their batteries in the surf, the tidal pools, and the seagrasses for generations. But that pristine sand between your toes isn't what you think. It likely wasn't pushed there naturally by the waves. It was most likely dredged up through a giant vacuum on a ship offshore, pumped through a hose, sifted through a gigantic box, and spread out by earth-moving trucks. It's called beach nourishment, and it's happened 265 times on dozens of North Carolina beaches over the decades. Often that process is the only thing keeping a beach house from collapsing, and sea level rise is making the issue much, much worse in places like Avon.
No one can argue that it's happening, and nobody can argue that we have to either make a decision to do something or make a decision to do nothing. And so that's how we look at it. We've made a decision to do something.
Bobby Outen is the Dare County manager. He's been tasked with creating a plan to accrue enough money to fight beach erosion in the Hatteras Island community.
The only reason there's a Dare County is because we have beaches. There's no other reason to be here. We don't have any agriculture. We don't have any industry. 90% of our land is owned by the state or federal government, and so we have this little strand of beaches, and that's what everybody, the 35,000 people that live here, that's what we live here for, that beach. And so our leaders have decided that we need to keep and maintain that beach, and that's what we've done.
So who pays for this? Who pays to move tons of sand around a beach, sand that's likely to be gone when the first hurricane or nor'easter comes along? Well, we all are, and it doesn't really matter where you live or what state you're in.
You know, right now everybody wants a beach. I mean, beach communities from Saco Beach, Maine, all the way to Padre Island, Texas, want to try to hold their beaches in place by pumping sand. And every one of them would love for the federal government to pay as much as possible.
Rob Young is director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University.
We do basic scientific research into coastal processes, coastal storm impacts, coastal restoration, and we communicate that science to decision makers at all levels. Everything from individual property owners associations, municipalities, state government, federal government.
As part of the program, Young has tracked the prevalence and cost of beach nourishment projects across the country dating back nearly a century.
Yes. So if you've been to the beach in the southern part of North Carolina, Carolina Beach, Wrightsville Beach, you've been walking on artificially pumped sand for 50 years. We've been doing beach nourishment projects in the southern part of the state for a long time. The northern Outer Banks are sort of new to beach nourishment. Up until about 10 years ago, there had been no artificial beach anywhere from Sandbridge, Virginia, all the way down to Oregon Inlet, basically. And then, you know, at Oregon Inlet, they placed a little bit of sand there due to some erosion around the inlet. And then you were renourishment free all the way through Cape Lookout National Seashore until you got to Atlantic Beach. But nowadays, the beach nourishment projects are happening up north as well. So We are currently, you know, trying to build beaches along most of the North Carolina shoreline, except those areas that are protected as national seashores.
In a ballpark, what are we? How much money are we talking about? How much has been spent in North Carolina since we've started keeping track, or since you've started keeping track on beach nourishment projects here?
Well, more than $1 billion for about 135 million cubic yards of sand. So it's a lot of sand and a lot of money.
And historically, these efforts in North Carolina were sort of paid for by the federal government, but that largely kind of stopped in the George W. Bush administration, I think. And give us a sense historically how these things have been paid for up until kind of today.
Yes. Historically, the federal government has paid the lion's share of beach nourishment costs. There was an effort through the Bush administration and the Obama administration to sort of wean folks off federal dollars for beach nourishment. But with the massive post-storm spending bills from Katrina, Sandy, Maria, and Harvey, the Corps of Engineers received a lot more money again for beach nourishment projects. And the federal dollars have really continued flowing to much of the country. Now, the strange thing is that there's really no good consistency in where those federal funds go. So the projects at, again, Carolina and Wrightsville have received federal funding for decades. The Northern Outer Banks has received no federal funding through the Corps of Engineers, at least. So they've had to pay for their beach nourishment projects largely locally. Now, there's one exception to this. And 10 or 15 years ago, the Federal Emergency Management Agency decided that beach nourishment projects were infrastructure. So when you have a beach eroded or some artificial beach sand removed during a named tropical storm, a community can apply to FEMA to get federal money to put some of that sand back. And so some federal money has flowed into the Northern Outer Banks projects through that. So it's a little bit complicated. Right now, the federal government is still spending a lot of money on beach nourishment, but you know that can't possibly go on forever.
And not only is it sort of protecting the beaches so that weekend folks can roll up to a beach and park in a public access area and go onto the beach, but it's also holding the beach, obviously, for the multi-million dollar houses that are on the beach. And while FEMA might have called it infrastructure, a lot of people see this as a giveaway to people who can own and afford to own those houses, where you're protecting essentially their real estate. And that causes a lot of frustration, anger for some people, even in the coastal communities, it seems like. I mean, it seems like not only is it complicated economically, it's complicated socioeconomically in that way. Is that a fairly accurate description?
Yeah, definitely. There's no question that the primary beneficiaries of beach nourishment projects are oceanfront property owners. And in the state of North Carolina, 98% or more of that oceanfront property is owned by absentee landlords. I mean, those are not primary residences, right? That is investment property. Let's be clear. A lot of it is owned by LLCs and corporations because people are renting that out. These are investments. And I think it's also incredibly important for people to understand coastal erosion and storms doesn't destroy beaches. You know, a lot of times I'll read a newspaper article after Hurricane Dorian goes by or something like that, and something will say, well, Hurricane Dorian severely eroded and eliminated the beach in X community. Well, it really doesn't happen that way. You know, sea level was, 330, 40 feet lower at the end of the last ice age, 15,000 years ago. That's like last Tuesday to a geologist. And our shorelines were miles further offshore when that was the case. And they have moved to where they are right now without the beaches disappearing. So it's really important for people to understand that the beach wants to move. It doesn't disappear. When shorelines are impacted by storms or long-term sea level rise, all they do is change position. The problem comes when we put homes in the way, or a road or infrastructure or something like that. Beach nourishment doesn't really protect the beach. It protects the houses. You know, if what you want to do is protect your tax base, then putting back that sand in front of the houses makes sense. But we have to be really clear that if we took the houses out of the way, there would be a beach there. It would just be where the houses are. The beach wants to be in a different place.
Just this past weekend on the Outer Banks, there was no giant storm, no nor'easter, no named hurricane. It was kind of just a windy couple of days. And yet Highway 12 had water on it and sand was blowing over it and they had to close portions of it for a period of time. These beaches, as they're moving, like you talked about, it isn't just storms that cause them. It isn't climate change exacerbating it, although it is, obviously. You know, this is a big question. What's the answer? Obviously, there are people who say we can't just abandon these places. They're too important to the state of North Carolina. They're too important to livelihoods. But is there a way for managed retreat from some of the areas that are going to be hardest hit?
Absolutely. No one would suggest that it's time to abandon the coast or even the barrier islands. I wouldn't suggest that. I mean, I grew up on the coast. I love to go to the beach. I've got two kids. I take them to the beach. We often rent a beach house on the oceanfront sometimes when we can afford it. So, I don't want the coastal economy to go away, and I don't want the beach houses, all of them, to go away. But we have to be sensible about this. So first of all, coastal retreat does not mean the end to the coastal economy and that we take everything away. We're not going to send the stormtroopers in and order everybody off the beach. That's not how it's going to happen. But there are portions of our coast that are more sustainable than others. And the Outer Banks is a perfect example. You know, we've got some really very narrow places that are erosion hotspots, and all the emergency managers in every municipality and county know exactly where those places are. When the wind starts blowing the wrong way on a full moon, you know, people have to respond. And the sensible way to manage this system is to be able to take baby steps back in a planned way from those areas that are most vulnerable and costing us the most money right now. And maintaining some of these places costs a tremendous amount of money, but not just money, time and effort of North Carolina DOT and emergency managers. Oh my goodness, just so much energy to protect places that are the most vulnerable. South Nags Head, North Carolina is a perfect example. North Topsail Beach. These are places that we all know about where the houses are constantly in danger. And to me, the way to do this sensibly is to take a step back from those areas. In North Topsail Beach, we did a study examining the potential for buying out 300 to 400 properties on the north end of the island, which sounds like a ridiculous plan, but it's not. It would be cheaper than holding the shoreline in place. And you know what? It's only 3% of their tax base. So, you know, our perspective on this is that what if we took all the money that we spend protecting those highly vulnerable areas and spent it on those places that are the most sustainable in those coastal communities? That's how you protect the coastal economy for the long run, I think.
So now I want to ask sort of when you offer these suggestions and advice to people in different parts of the world, what they say. I mean, in North Carolina, I remember a couple years ago, I guess it's about 9 years ago now, that the legislature sort of famously banned sea level rise. But it wasn't all that funny because what they were essentially doing was saying the state is not going to do anything about this. And we're going to prevent local communities from doing anything about it. And we're going to shrink the window by which we're even going to look at sea level rise out into 30 years instead of beyond. Now, that has loosened up somewhat, but it does sort of show the resistance that's in the political system here in North Carolina and elsewhere. And so when you go and offer suggestions like you just mentioned, how are those received?
Yeah, well, I was an author on that sea level rise report, of course, and it did make my life interesting for a couple of years. And, you know, how these suggestions are received really depends upon, you know, who you're talking to. So let me just say that the professional staffs of North Carolina municipalities and counties, they get it. And they are extremely interested in ideas like very carefully managed strategic retreat. There's no question about that in my mind. It's the elected officials that are problematic. They're responding to 2, 3, 4 year election cycles. They really firmly believe in their hearts that shrinking their tax base would cause them to lose re-election, that it's somehow a bad thing for their community. And I think that that's largely because historically that might have been true, but it's a different world we live in right now. You know, it's hard to gain traction for these kinds of ideas with elected officials in coastal communities. There's not a lot of love for any discussion of taking a step back from the ocean front. And I think we don't have, you know, a whole lot of really good case studies to present to people, which is why we did this very detailed North Topsail Beach study, which, by the way, still has not really gained any traction with any elected officials in North Topsail Beach. But that's okay. You know, we wanted to give people a straw man proposal to try and poke holes in. And I don't think we've had anybody give us a serious response to the numbers in our proposal that indicate that it would be cheaper to do the buyout than it would be to continue to try to hold the shoreline in place with beach nourishment and building a terminal groin. Again, this is not retreating from the coast. It's retreating from the places where we're just throwing money in the water. It's important for folks living in coastal communities to understand that the federal money is going to end sometime soon. So if you want to keep doing beach nourishment, everybody needs to be working out ways to finance those projects locally. You know, I think that one, we have to understand that we're going to have to be paying for these projects ourselves. The other thing we need to understand is ultimately we're going to be running out of sand in places. So it's not going to be, do we have the money? It's going to be, can we still find enough sand to do this? In the southern part of North Carolina, this is going to become a bigger and bigger issue in the future. You know, we're going to be running out of affordable sand that's high quality enough to put on the beach. And it's already happening in a lot of places. I mean, Dade County, Florida, Palm Beach County, Florida, I mean, they are out of sand. So, you know, anybody who really wants to be preserving the coastal economy over the long run and doesn't want to see a sudden collapse needs to be really honest about these issues, about the financing, about the long-term viability, have upfront discussions about it. Don't paint those concerns as doom and gloom, but, you know, let's all put it on the table and figure out where the most sustainable areas are, spend our money there, and come up with a good long-term plan.
Rob Young is the director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. More in a moment.
Hey, sorry to interrupt your podcast listening. I'll be quick. I'm Lindsay Foster Thomas. I'm the content director at North Carolina Public Radio WUNC. And I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you to everyone who supports WUNC. It makes Tested and all the WUNC podcasts and programs possible. If you haven't yet made a contribution, consider doing so now at WUNC.org. More than half of what it takes to operate WUNC comes from listener support, and your support today is so appreciated. Become a sustainer or increase your monthly gift at WUNC.org. And thanks.
I've been at WUNC for going on 2 decades now. Over that time, our growing newsroom has had to be nimble, ready to cover everything from a hurricane to bonfires following basketball championships to an explosion at a Slim Jim factory. A year ago, the scope of the pandemic was just coming into view. Normally, when we start to report on something, we begin with some basic facts, we search for affected or expert voices, and expand and report out what we learn from there. But this was different because we knew so little, and those affected were beyond scared, and the experts were desperately trying to gather their own facts. Throw in a torrent of misinformation, and it was a challenging landscape to find the truth. It was in this state of being tested that we started this podcast.
And what are we going to do? Do we have to go into martial law or not? And goodness knows, I do not want to be a part of martial law.
I live with my grandmother, and I was tasked with finding the oh-so-precious toilet paper.
So let's start there with Rose Hoban, the editor of North Carolina Health News. Are lawmakers like Governor Roy Cooper making the right decisions to stem the outbreak here in North Carolina?
Frankly, I think they've all done a pretty good job. They're doing a lot of communicating, which I think is useful. I think Cooper is listening to his DHHS people, you know, the scientists, the epidemiologists.
It began as a pretty rudimentary daily rundown of what we were learning each day, born out of an urgent need to feel like we were offering some helpful context to a virus we're still, a year later, figuring out. Over the past 12 months, we've examined how the pandemic has upended various facets of our society, from education to incarceration. We've also expanded the scope of the program with my colleague, Leonita Inge, to discuss systemic inequality, racism, and social justice, clear evidence that we're being tested daily in numerous ways. COVID has taken the lives of nearly 12,000 North Carolinians, so it feels especially important we recognize the people we've lost. Over the course of the next few episodes and on the radio, we will do that by telling some of their life stories. And looking beyond that, while it's promising to see the continued rollout of vaccines and the bolstered safety of our loved ones and community, it's evident the effects of the pandemic are going to be with us for a very long time. While case numbers will inevitably go down, the economic and psychological consequences will surely linger. Returning back to a pre-pandemic normal may not be possible, but continuing to carve out space to talk about it is, at the least, a step in the right direction. That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Dave DeWitt. Charlie Shelton Orman produced this episode. Amanda Magnus is our editor. Lindsay Foster Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.